May it please the Court. I'm going to rely primarily on the reply brief with respect to the waiver argument, unless the Court has specific questions otherwise. I believe that that argument was fully addressed in that brief, and that the waiver that's alleged in there by the appellees we've addressed fully. And unless the Court has any questions, I'll just move straight into the main argument. The issue for this court is what sets this case apart from any other Chapter 74 expert report case. Why did this trial court commit an abuse of discretion here? And I'll refer to the appellants collectively as Dr. Walters for everybody's convenience. I'll state that there are five issues, and the fifth one being the most lengthy. First, Dr. Burns' report was not intended to aid the court or to comply with Chapter 74. On page 34 of the clerk's record, which is the report, the stated purpose of Dr. Burns' report was to aid the State Board of Dental Examiners, not the trial court and not this court. In fact, it's easy to see why a busy trial court was unable to accurately parse each section of Dr. Burns' report, because it was not laid out for any court's convenience. It did not address standard of care, breach, causation, damages. It addressed a myriad of issues, all mixed, all interlaced, not in any way separated out as to what addresses legal causation, which is important to the trial court and this court, and what might be important to the State Board of Dental Examiners. Number two, Dr. Burns' report states that it is based on speculative facts. Quote, because there are not definitive documents in this case, the actual times are variable because they are based on recollection of the parties after the fact. That's page 34, paragraph 2.
No, you said it didn't. He didn't say in his report that it violated the standard of care?
Did it violate a standard of care? I would submit that it is intermingled throughout. The introductory paragraphs of this report state, I do not make any differentiation between what is important to the State Board of Dental Examiners standard of care and what might be a legal standard of care, which is applicable and important for the trial court to determine here. Third, Dr. Byrne, and going to that issue, Justice McCoy, he recognized that there was a distinction between legal causation and the board's standards, and yet he made no attempt to distinguish the two. Again, looking at page 34, paragraphs 3 and 4, it is my opinion that a case review for a licensing board is different from that of a civil negligence case. Therefore, in my report, I will also list all standard of care violations I note in this case committed by Dr. Walters, be they causal to damages or not, in an effort to assist the board, not to assist the trial court in making its abuse of discretion standard review of does this report accurately apprise, number one, the defendant of what the issues are, and number two, assist the trial court in determining is there a prima facie case made here. It is horribly and irrevocably intermingled. And for that reason, if the trial court looked at these things that go to board issues and was unable to determine if those were legal causation standards, then the trial court abused its discretion. Fourth, Dr. Burns stated that Ms. Taylor's cause of death resulted from intertwined causes, but he did not separate out those causes allegedly attributable to Dr. Burns. In the section titled Cause of Patient Death, which is toward the end, Dr. Burns states that his opinion regarding Ms. Taylor's death is based on the known sequence of events. That's Clerk's Record 39, paragraph 2. And that, Justice McCoy, is directly contrary to his preliminary statement that the actual times are variable. They're a guess based on an amalgamation of all the witnesses' statements, testimony, and so forth for the State Board of Dental Examiners. And that's, again, page 34, paragraph 2. In one section, he is saying, gosh, we just don't know. I'm going to give you my best guess. And then in another section, he's saying, that's it. I know that that's it. Directly contrary to what he said at the beginning. The fifth issue I'm going to bring up to this court is, what are the actual things alleged? And I took the time to go through what are the standard of care violations, and he had separated them out into two different areas. One, section one, is record keeping. That's Clerk's Record 40 through 44. There are 12 subsections. 11 of these alleged record keeping violations do not contain any mention of causation, which is the sole issue we've appealed to this court. Do not contain any mention of causation as to Ms. Taylor's death, stating only that the alleged breach places Dr. Walter's anesthesia patients at risk. The case law is very clear that the purpose of the expert report is to apprise the defendant and to aid the trial court in determining the issue of causation as to this plaintiff, these damages. So for that reason, 11 of the 12 subsections in that beginning portion, standard of care violation section 1, don't even meet the standard on its face. Number 9, which is on page 44, does state that a second dose of anesthesia, quote, contributed to Ms. Taylor's respiratory depression. But two sentences before that, Dr. Byrne acknowledges that no one knows whether a second dose of anesthesia was actually administered to Ms. Taylor or was wasted. So for that reason, that sole subsection that has anything to do with causation is based on sheer speculation, based on the plain language of the report. Going to the last issue, standard of care violation section 2, this is clerk's records 45 through 49, there's no explanation for why the alternative method would have been better in section 1 and section 5. Those are pages 45 and 49 of the clerk's record. Section 1, the expert opines that Ms. Taylor should have had the tooth removed under local anesthesia rather than general anesthesia. That's the entire conclusion in that subsection. From what can the trial court infer? Trial court is not allowed to infer. As this court has recently held in Maris and the Texas Supreme Court has held in other cases, trial court may not look beyond the four corners of this expert report in addressing causation. Similarly, subsection 5 does not explain how the specific monitoring identified would have prevented Ms. Taylor's death. Two other portions of the standard of care violation section 2, speculative facts. Section 3, he specifically states, we have no way to know before he reaches his conclusion on causation. Section 4, an apparent lack of emergency training caused Ms. Taylor's death. Again, does not identify what that lack was, what needed to have been done differently. And finally, the majority of the sections are conclusory. Sections 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10 all state that Dr. Walters had a deficient fund of knowledge and that this was the negligent decision that caused Ms. Taylor's death. This court and other courts, and these cases are cited in the brief, have looked at gaps in causation, have looked at the four corners of the expert report. And again, the purpose of the expert report is to, number one, advise the defendant what is the allegation, and number two, provide the trial court a base level of knowledge and application of what these missing, or excuse me, what the causation is. This report, as I've gone through each subsection, does not do that. Collectively, it throws a lot of stuff at the wall. It doesn't throw them at a courthouse wall. It throws them at a wall on Guadalupe Street in Austin at the Texas State Board of Dental Examiners, which has a different standard, as Dr. Byrne very clearly recognized and stated up front in his report. I won't go into all the cases, but just generally speaking, Windsor out of this court, Clark out of the El Paso Court of Appeals, Myers out of the Corpus Christi Courts of Appeals. Each of these cases have held that if the report itself contains analytical gaps, if the four corners of the report do not address causation, that is an abuse of discretion. And respectfully, I would submit that that is what has occurred here, unlike the vast majority of cases where you have someone who comes in, knows the legal standard, knows the application, sets out, this is what happened, this is causation, these are the things that did not go into it, these are the things that did go into it, this is how we got to this result. And respectfully, this report does not do that. And with that, I will...
It looks to me like at the front of the report that Dr. Byrne indicates that he's including more than just those things required in a civil negligence case. He's including additional standard of care violations, be it whether they had a causal relationship or not, but it doesn't say that he's excluding those that have a causal relationship.
And Your Honor, that is the crux of the problem. He does not specifically state that any one of those factors gets you to causation. He does not specifically link which one of these issues gets you to the end result. Now, I've gone through, again, each subsection, and I'd ask this court to do that, to take the time and go through from page 40 to 49 each of these subsections as I have. And you will see intermingled, you will see phrases that have something to do with whatever the standard of care is, whatever the legal whatever the causation standard may be for that purpose, but you won't see the legal standard. You won't.
Paragraph 3, violated the standard of care by ... contributed to the death of Ms. Taylor. Chapter 4, lack of emergency training informant caused Ms. Taylor's death. Paragraph 5, maintain an adequate airway which caused the death of Ms. Taylor.
And respectfully, Your Honor, I agree those words are in there.
Yeah.
And if we look further back in each paragraph, again, looking at Section 5, does not explain how the specific monitoring identified would have prevented Ms. Taylor's death. I can stand here and say that something caused something, but if I don't base it on facts, if I'm speculating, if I'm guessing, that's not good enough. That is not good enough under our law and should not be good enough.
But isn't there case law that says that the expert reports don't have to use the magic words, that they just have to show link up? Doesn't these words do that? I mean, there's no requirement that he use words that lawyers would use in courtrooms.
That is absolutely correct, Judge. But those links still have to be based on facts. They can't be speculative. They can't be contrary to other assumptions that have been made, and they have to get you to the end result. And I would submit, going through each of these subsections, and respectfully, Judge, yes, there is the word in there. This caused this. But if you look at each subsection individually, you don't get to that result.
He established the standard of care. He
says
he violated the standard of care, and the violation of the standard of care contributed to the death of Ms. Taylor.
Contributed to the death is not the same thing as legal causation. And while I agree with Justice Walker that you don't need magic words, this case, again, this report was created for a separate purpose. Had this individual come in and addressed to this court what the issues are, then respectfully, I wouldn't be standing here. I wouldn't be making this argument to this court.
But honestly, counsel, this report is about five times longer and about five times more detailed than the normal expert reports that we see on appeal. And it really kind of, I'm really having a hard time seeing that the defendant does not understand what the allegations against him are as a basis of this report and how it's alleged that his conduct contributed to or caused the death of his patient.
And Judge, I'm not saying that the defendant is not aware, but that's one part of the two-part test. The second part is that it has to apprise the trial court of a prima facie basis for this case to go forward. And this report, while it is certainly thick, just like in a summary judgment proceeding, just because I file 6 inches doesn't mean there's a fact issue in there somewhere. This report, on its face, you look at it, it is very comprehensive, and it addressed whatever the dental standard of care may be down in Austin in a licensing proceeding. Does not address the legal standard. And by comparison, I'd refer to the court to the recent case, August 29th, out of Justice Gardner and Walker and Justice Holman's panel, considered and rejected a challenge to a Chapter 74 expert report involving an ophthalmologist damaging a plaintiff's retina. And in that case, the expert identified a specific list of failures on the part of the defendant and concluded that any one of these failures is sufficient enough to have caused damage to the retina. And that goes to your point, Justice McCoy, which was, did these things contribute? It certainly says that. Did any one of these individual things standing alone cause it? Did they collectively cause it? This expert does not conclude it.
What about the report summary? It is my opinion Dr. Walter's negligent acts are responsible for the demise of Miss Elizabeth Taylor.
And that's where we get into a question of, Can an expert just say these negligent acts without saying specifically?
Well, he did specify, like, for 10 pages before that, didn't he?
And again, I would submit that if the court looks at each individual one, as the trial court should have, you don't get there. And I'll save my rebuttal time, but I'll tender the remainder of my opening back to the court.
morning, Your Honors. Please, the court. Mark Sutter arguing here on behalf of the appellee, Trina Hudoba. Your Honors, if I know you've read the briefing. This was an absolutely terrible case. The defendant committed extreme malpractice. There's no issue in this appeal that malpractice was committed. They haven't contested that. He placed a patient under general anesthesia in his office just to pull a tooth when she was overweight and had all sorts of heart problems and breathing problems and apnea and pre-existing conditions, which according to the objective criteria that dentists are supposed to use, says you cannot even use general anesthesia on this patient because of exactly this risk occurring, respiratory depression and death. The drugs that he used, they were multiple failed attempts to administer drugs. Extra drugs were given. He talks about how that led to respiratory distress, as those drugs do, how immediately her blood was noted to be dark, even though her heart was continuing to pump and she continued to have pressure for some time. And the oxygen saturation dropped precipitously once they got her hooked back up to it because she hadn't been monitored up to that point. There were botched attempts to intubate her, as he talks about, and when the EMS people at last arrived, they've got the tube in her stomach. There's just no dispute.
Others were not the jury.
I understand. Let me move on.
Why don't we get up to the legal?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, but the doctor would come in and say he can't. That this is a bad report because it was written for the State Board of Dental Examiners instead of cooked up by a plaintiff's lawyer for a lawsuit is ridiculous. The point of the requirement is to ensure the court that the claims have a basis and it's not a frivolous claim. What better way than to go get a report written by the Board of Medical Examiners as opposed to going out and paying some expert that they can't even depose and writing his report for him like often happens. It provides reasonable notice. It provides a basis for the trial court to conclude the claims have merit. They've cited six or seven cases in their brief which they claim are controlling and they claim are similar. Every single one of those cases, Your Honor, every single one that they have cited and discussed this morning was where a trial court dismissed a case and the Court of Appeals said that was okay under the abuse of discretion standard. They haven't cited a single case to show you how bad a report has to be for a Court of Appeals to reverse a trial court's refusal to dismiss a case. In fact, some of the cases they cited, for example, the Barco case, they cite the Barco case. And Justice McCoy, on behalf of this court in the Farishta case, distinguished that Barco case and said, look, in the Barco case, the expert report on the issue of causation consisted of one sentence stating, quote, these violations of the standard of emergency medical practice were a proximate cause in this patient's injury. And then, Your Honor, you went on and said that in the Farishta case, and the cite on that is 224 3rd 448, you said, in this case, Dr. Hamill's report indicates that the standard of care was to perform certain tests on Ashraf, that the tests weren't performed, nor were they required by the hospital, and that the failure to perform or require these tests allowed an infection to be present, that this infection caused respiratory distress, cyanosis, pneumonia, and other injuries, and that the initiation of appropriate therapy would have prevented the infection, close quote. Based on that, this court reversed the trial court's dismissal and said that was a good faith effort. Now, the report in this case goes way, way beyond that, as Your Honors have noted. But again, Barco, Windsor, Zavala, Clark, Myers, even the Supreme Court's case of Earl, which is cited for a general proposition, every one of those cases was upholding the trial court's discretion. In fact, in several of those cases, they specifically said, we might have decided it differently, but we're going to uphold the trial court's discretion. The report in this case clearly says I'm going to discuss both types of violations, those that caused an injury and those that just give the board insight onto this doctor's behavior. And he set them out in two separate sections, and he says completely clearly right there at the top of the first section, I believe it's on page 40, section 1, in this section, I'll discuss the record-keeping standard of care violations to provide the board an insight into Dr. Walter's practice, philosophy, and attention to the standards of care. That's record page 40. And he goes through and he lists 12 of them, which counsel discussed. Then we get to Section 2, beginning on record page 45. In this section, I'll discuss the standard of care violations committed by Dr. Walters, which led to Ms. Taylor's demise. And then he goes through and lists the ones that he says are causative, and he doesn't repeat himself in each time and say, this led to her demise, this led to her demise, but if you read the four corners of the report, that's clearly what he says. So, they say that, in their brief, they say he failed to rule out other causes. He failed to establish, first of all, they say he failed to establish causation. And counsel said there has to be prima facie proof of causation. There doesn't. And there's no case that says that. The one case they cited to say you have to establish causation is the Park Place, Texas Supreme Court case, which had nothing to do with statutory expert reports. It was a summary judgment case on whether there was prima facie evidence. What an expert report has to do is provide, it has to be a good faith summary of the expert's opinions as to causation, sufficient to inform the court that the claims have merit. You don't have to establish anything. You don't have to marshal evidence. You don't have to prove anything. You don't even have to be right. He says it doesn't rule out other causes, the brief says. Well, it explains specifically and in some detail that the medical examiner ruled out catastrophic cause of death such as stroke or myocardial infarction, and furthermore he says the physical and microscopic findings are consistent with respiratory distress and cardiac arrest. And furthermore, he doesn't disagree with the ME about that. The ME said it was cardiac arrest was the ultimate cause of death, and he wrote down manner of death natural. And so Dr. Burns writes to the ME and says, I agree with you that it was cardiac, but since it was all caused by this surgical procedure and the anesthesia, we shouldn't say natural, we should say accidental. It's a semantic difference about manner of death, not even cause of death, manner of death, natural, accidental. Anyway, it's not conclusory. A conclusory statement, as the case is cited in our brief, is one that doesn't set forth the facts on which it's based. This sets forth numerous facts on which it's based and does a pretty good job of tying them to his conclusions. I could go on, but it's a four corners analysis. It's silly for me to sit up here and try to read or summarize the report because I know y'all have all read it yourselves. So let me just, unless you want me to go on, let me turn and say a few words about our waiver argument. They, as the appellant, saying that the judge should have sustained their objections, have a burden to show in the record that they made a timely and specific objection. They didn't. What the record shows is they just said, we object because this was a report prepared by a member of the board, and it was a confidential report, and he's not qualified, and it's insufficient under the statute. It's not sufficient. Causation is conclusory. Okay? Now, I filed an objection to that saying, well, look, you're getting a second bite at the apple. You had to file all your objections within 21 days. All the objections you filed were overruled, so you don't have any more objections. It hadn't been overruled. Judge Curry, and it's specifically in his order denying their motion to dismiss, it says he overruled my objection in that regard. So that was an argument that was presented to the court. They say in their brief that we stated in our motion to Judge Curry that, or in our response to the motion to dismiss, they say we stated that the original objections included a causation objection. And they cite footnote 1 of our response. We did not state that, and you can read footnote 1. It doesn't say anything about that. It says, what it says is what I just said. All of your objections had to be made within 21 days. The objections you made within 21 days were overruled. Therefore, you don't have any more objections. Then we went on and said, subject to that, we're going to address this causation argument. And that's what we did, and that's what we had a hearing on, and Judge Curry considered it and gave them a second bite at the apple and overruled it again properly. And it's not my burden. I'm not here claiming of an error. They say that I've waived that by somehow not... Well, first of all, the judge overruled their objections. He didn't err. I don't have to preserve error. If he had granted their objections, then I would be in here complaining, well, those were untimely, and I would have to show that. But maybe that's why he overruled their objections. Maybe he noticed they were untimely. Who knows? Furthermore, they say I can't take an inconsistent position here. First of all, as I tried to express, I did not in the trial court state that the subsequent objections included causation. I never said that. But even if I had, the trial court overruled my objection in that regard and went on and considered their motion. In order for me to be judicially estopped to take an inconsistent position, I have to have been granted relief based on that prior inconsistent position. And there's two cases, there's a hand, what is it? Two cases out of this court, one that just went up to the Court of Appeals, or excuse me, to the Supreme Court. First of all, you can look at the Horsley-Lehman case, which is Fort Worth Court of Appeals, 221 Southwest 3rd, 802, which specifically says, to establish judicial estoppel, there's three elements, and one of them is the previous court must have accepted the previous position. And then in this crazy Pleasant Glade Assembly of God versus Schubert case out of this court that the Supreme Court just wrote on, they again said the doctrine of judicial estoppel precludes a party from adopting a position inconsistent with one it maintained successfully in an earlier proceeding. Well, the judge overruled my objection that so I didn't maintain that successfully, even if I had somehow conceded that their later objection included causation, which it doesn't. So their objection was not timely, and it was waived. Ogletree, Texas Supreme Court, clearly says if you don't object to the, if you don't file any objections that you have to the expert report within 21 days, then all your objections are waived. In their reply brief, all he said in response to my waiver argument, all he said in response to my argument that they didn't make a specific objection on causation was, I didn't preserve error, and that's inconsistent. They have not said I'm wrong. They haven't said, yes, we did make a causation argument. They haven't said, yes, we did make a specific argument. They haven't said that's somehow included in our general objection, and general objections are okay. They haven't said it, because that's not the law, and they know it. And they can't say it now. What they've said is I waived it, and they're wrong about that. Thank you.
To the extent I was not clear, yes, we preserved our causation argument. Yes, we could preserved our causation objection. Ogletree, issued by the Texas Supreme Court last year, November 30th, states that the hospital in that case did not preserve their objection. They didn't make an objection. Texas Supreme Court went through what is a sufficiency objection under the statute. Sufficiency requires these elements, causation being one of them. We made a sufficiency objection under Ogletree. It is included. It includes all the elements.
Well, if that's the case, and all the elements, you're saying that just by challenging the sufficiency, you challenged all the elements, why wasn't that overruled when the trial court overruled your objection that supposedly raised causation by raising sufficiency?
That's not in the appellate record, Your Honor. I cannot say. I can't say why the trial court made a particular ruling in that way. I can't say what the judge was considering at the time of the hearing.
But
I can say that the statute is, with all due respect, poorly laid out in that it has this 21-day window and a 120-day window. And in my interpretation of the statute, the purpose of that is to allow the defendant to make a blanket objection to the sufficiency of the report and then give the plaintiff the opportunity to fix it, to fix whatever it is. Typically, the difference between the 21-day and the 120-day, that wide window, is the opportunity for the parties and the trial court to figure out what's wrong with this report and give the plaintiff the chance to fix it. The statute does have an additional 30-day window if, as Texas Supreme Court held in Leland versus Brandall recently, if they ask for that additional 30-day grace period, if a court of appeals sends it back down and says that this is insufficient, they get another 30 days to fix it. And that's what the statute says.
Well, I think what Judge Walker is saying is if it's your position, all you have to say is it's insufficient.
It is sufficient.
Let me finish.
Yes, sir.
And you don't say it's insufficient because of causation, then when the trial court overrules your objection, it also, by definition, overrules your assertion that causation was insufficient, and so you don't get another bite at the apple.
As far as bite at the apple goes, that's the problem with the 21-day to 120-day window, is one of the issues that...
Wait, let's go back to my question.
Yes, sir.
If you say, I don't have to say causation, I can just say sufficiency...
Yes, sir.
Then when the trial court overruled it, it included overruling causation being insufficient, and therefore we're done with it. And you've addressed it, you lost, the trial court said no, it's sufficient, you don't get to go back and urge it again.
Then why does the statute have the opportunity for an interlocutory appeal after 120 days? Then that would be an inconsistency in the statute.
Okay, but your position, all you have to say is insufficient.
But yes, that is correct, sir.
You don't have to say causation, damages, nothing.
I do not have to break
the waterfront.
I apologize. Yes, okay. Yes, sir. That's correct. Under Ogletree, we do not have to break it out. We do have to make the assertion, and if we choose to make a specific assertion, then we can do that.
And how is he supposed to go back and fix it if he doesn't know what you're saying is insufficient?
Then certainly they need to ask.
Like have a hearing.
Exactly.
Like we had here.
Exactly.
Object to your objection.
Exactly. And it's similar to a special exception. Say, Judge, I don't know what they're talking about. But the clerk's record in this case shows they knew exactly what we were talking about. They addressed each of these on the merits. They knew that we were talking about qualifications. They knew we were talking about causation. Now, we've only brought the causation issue up to this court, but we were talking about qualifications and causation in the trial court.
But so you're telling me that there's references to causation at the first hearing, the first time that the trial court overruled
your
objections?
Does not appear in the appellate record, Your Honor.
Well, that's the problem, is that you had two hearings on objections, and I'm not sure that the statute contemplates that. The statute contemplates one hearing addressing all objections, because otherwise, what's the purpose of having to make all your objections within 21 days? You're really not having to do that if you can keep up having multiple hearings on objections that you said were made up here, but evidently somehow weren't ruled on when the trial court ruled at the first hearing. In other words, that to me, that's the whole purpose of the 21-day limit on objections, is to create an endpoint when everyone says, okay, we're through with all this expert report stuff now, on with the discovery, on with the litigation, instead of, you know, you could basically 30 days before trial have another hearing on your expert, on the expert report, and say that you are now challenging the cause and fact element of proximate cause on the expert report. That doesn't make any sense to me.
If I could answer that question, I will tell the court that I've looked at the full legislative history, and there is nothing on the 21-day rule. There is nothing about having a hearing. There is nothing about addressing this. The 120 days out, that was the focus of everyone's questioning. What are we going to do? When should we cut this off? And to answer your question, Justice Walker, the 120 days is the cutoff. If I haven't addressed it and the plaintiff responded, and at that point we're locked into what the positions are, we have the dismissal hearing under under 74-351B. We have that dismissal hearing, and then if I'm unsuccessful in having a dismissal, then I have a right to interlocutory appeal at that point. I don't have it from the objections earlier on at the 21-day. I think the legislature contemplated that and said that this 120 days, that's the end point when the plaintiff has got to have all their ducks in a row And hopefully the parties have gone back and forth and addressed this in some form or fashion, as did happen here, I certainly admit. But that's the point at which they've got to have their report in, and then I have an appellate remedy at that point. I don't have an appellate remedy from a garden variety addressing my objections when there is no cutoff.
Well, why not? I mean, the 120 days goes to what the plaintiff has to do, not to what you have to do. The plaintiff has to file their expert report within 120 days after they file suit. I don't see that that has anything to do with what the defense has to do. The defense has to file their objections within 21 days of getting the plaintiff's expert report. So I don't understand. I don't think that the 120 days has anything to do with any action by the defense. I think that once the trial court rules on objections, you can perfect your appeal right then. I don't see that the 120 days to file an expert report has anything to do with your appellate remedy.
I think that that would be, respectfully, I think that would be an inefficient use of the courts. Because if we do the 21-day objections, if we make that and have that there in place, and then I attempt to...
Where are you getting 120-day objections?
I'm sorry, Judge, 21 days. If I make my 21-day sufficiency objection under Ogletree, and all I say is it's insufficient, trial court overrules me. At that point, I don't have a right to interlocutory appeal. I suppose I could seek a mandamus relief, and I suppose...
Why don't you? Under 51014, the trial court has now denied your motion that the report was inadequate somehow, or your objections to it. I mean, why do you not...
I see what you're saying, Judge. 51.004A9 goes to 74.351B, my motion to dismiss, not to my objections. I don't have the right to interlocutory review of those 21-day objections until I file my 74.351B motion. And there's no purpose in doing that until we get to the 120 days and the parties' positions are locked in.
Okay, I understand. I understand what you're saying now.
Thank you, Judge. And my final point on that is we're not asking for a free walk. We're not asking for dismissal. We understand at the time we filed the appellant's brief, we asked for reversal. Since that time, Leland versus Brandall has come out by the Texas Supreme Court, and it says that if the plaintiff has asked for a 30-day extension to cure this specific deficiency, then they can go back and do that, even after appeal. So we understand that if this court were to hold that there was an abuse of discretion in finding that the causation issue was sufficient to apprise this trial court of the specific issues and problems on causation in this case, that it will go back and they will have an opportunity to cure. And we understand that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Your case is submitted.